From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. One of North Carolina's most vocal advocates of free speech on college campuses is a criminology professor at UNC Wilmington. He believes schools should add new First Amendment training to campus orientation. You'll learn why. State government is working on plans for recovery from Hurricane Matthew. You'll learn details. North Carolina lawmakers continue to look for ways to cut or consolidate the state's occupational licenses. But you'll hear why some members of the General Assembly aren't that interested in setting up a new state commission to handle that work. Plus, we'll profile North Carolina's newly elected state public school superintendent. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
President-elect Donald Trump has promised to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. Now, he says his goal is to lower costs and improve care by getting rid of what we commonly call Obamacare. So what exactly should the president-elect and his team do, and how long might it take? The John Locke Foundation's Director of Healthcare Policy, Catherine Restrepo, joins me now with a look at the future of Obamacare under a Trump administration. Catherine, welcome back.
Thank you.
What do you make of what the president-elect has said on the campaign trail and also in the first few days of his transition?
Mm-hmm. Well, sure. Well, there's a lot of unpredictability going on. During the campaign, during the Republican debates, Donald Trump was talking about favoring single-payer systems and looking at sort of Medicare for all systems that have been in place for a while in European countries. And then he has gone on to say, this law is a disaster. I want to repeal and replace it. And within the first couple of days after the election, in interviews with the Wall Street Journal and 60 Minutes, he's saying, well, more of an amend Obamacare, but repeal certain provisions, maybe keep intact the pre-existing condition clause where insurance companies have to cover everybody, regardless of whether their health status is, along with allowing plans to include dependents, family plans to include dependents up to the age of 26. So that's really what's going on right now.
Based on those comments, there are some who have said, well, that sounds reasonable, mm-hmm. and that would be part of a replacement mm-hmm. plan if you were to repeal Obamacare. Others have said, hey, wait a second, he's starting to hedge. What's your view on it?
Well, I think, first of all, if we look at the political feasibility of repealing and replacing Obamacare, I think, people are saying, oh my gosh, like this law is going to be dismantled within the first 100 days of office, and that's simply not true. It's really going to take a couple of years, I think. And what that looks like is that in 2017, there will be some type of a budget reconciliation bill, and what that really means is a partial repeal of Obamacare. So it would repeal the Medicaid expansion. It would repeal the taxing and spending under the law, the Cadillac tax, the insurance subsidies. And then so there would be a transition phase for 2 years. And during that 2-year transition phase, lawmakers would have to come together in Congress and devise a new proposal for what that replacement plan will look like. And then that would hopefully transition into 2019, when that would take effect.
If they follow the mm-hmm. outline that you've just discussed,
right,
people wouldn't be losing their insurance as that happened, would they?
Well, I don't know. I think there would be, even in the transition phase, I think some people may have to switch policies whether or not they like it. But overall, I think the idea is to not make it as disruptive as it was under Obamacare when the exchanges first opened up in 2014.
If you were advising the Trump team on uh-huh. what they should be doing,
yes.
and what would you tell them are the, mm-hmm. the guiding principles that they should be using as
sure.
they put this together?
Yes. Well, I think, first of all, the exchange structure, it's not a bad thing to have exchanges in an individual market. Actually, for a free market reform, completely free market, it would be ideal for everyone to not be on their employer-sponsored plan and buy health insurance on their own in this large nationwide individual market. There would be so much more competition that way. And people would actually be consumers who are the patients in charge of their individual policies would actually be exposed to what their healthcare plans cost. And insurance companies would have no choice but to cater more towards their demands, and they would have more of an incentive to make health insurance more affordable. And that way, you wouldn't need these subsidies that we have now. So because there's just so much of the cost that is masked in healthcare, in the healthcare system now, even before the Affordable Care Act passed in 2010, that's causing a problem.
So it sounds as if you think that rather than most people, and this is pretty traditional, mm-hmm. have some sort of a medical plan or perhaps dental insurance as well through their
right.
employer, but
right.
don't really know what anything costs because it's part of the benefit package.
Exactly.
So you would like to just have that separated completely
yes.
and have everybody go out and choose what they want to choose and know exactly what it costs.
Yes. Now, that is a very idealistic, pretty
right.
radical change. I think that a lot of people will not be happy with that.
That's why I'm like from 1 to 100 really, really
right.
fast.
But that's my opinion. yeah.
So when we yeah. talk about competition, why is it that competition is something that needs to be infused into this system if we're going to change it?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's if you think about just the healthcare system in general compared to other industries, it's just so backwards because there's so much innovation in healthcare, but prices keep going up. And that kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier, that the consumer, the patient really isn't the true customer in healthcare. Insurance companies are because they're the ones buying products and services on behalf of their policyholders. Their hospitals are. So until there can be more consumer control in the healthcare system, I think that will only incentivize producers of healthcare services to be more competitive and more transparent with their prices and how much things cost.
If it goes that way, would we be looking at a situation where it's one of those deals where you say, I want one from column A, one from column B, I'd like to have this covered, maybe mm-hmm. hospitalization, but if I get a cold, I want to just pay for it out of my pocket?
Sure. I mean, that's ultimately what I would hope the healthcare sector, the health insurance industry gets to at some point. I think the more consumer choice you have, whether you want to have things that are preventative that normally one would want to pay out of pocket for, want to have covered, fine. But if they want to have more of a catastrophic policy where they want to pay for preventative services like annual comprehensive physicals out of pocket and have hospitalization services covered, then it's up to the consumer decision, and it should be for them to make those decisions themselves.
And right now, the federal government is making those decisions through the mandates
That's
that
right.
are required to be in anyone's
That's
health
right.
insurance
yeah,
policy.
Yeah, I mean, if you just look at the preventative, the essential health benefits and the preventative services that have to be covered, I mean, on average, it's like 55 different preventative services that insurance companies have to cover in all of these insurance plans, these policies that are being sold. And it's so – backwards from what an insurance policy ought to look like.
You really want to flip this thing on its head.
Yes.
Right
yes.
now, the government is controlling things. You want consumers to
Absolutely.
Control things.
Yes.
We've heard the president-elect talk about having people be able to buy policies across state lines. What's
mm-hmm.
that all about?
Mm-hmm. Sure. So if you have a national company, United Healthcare, and you want to purchase a policy or a product that they're selling in another state compared to the state you're living in, you can do that. I mean, I know actually some states are doing that. It's just, it's really not prevalent across the nation.
For example, right now in North Carolina, there's only one or two providers mm-hmm. that you can actually buy insurance from, right?
Right. Yes. There's Blue Cross and Blue Shield in the individual market. So there's
right.
Blue Cross and Blue Shield and Cigna, which is only participating in about 5 or 6 counties in the Research Triangle region. So for the most part, policyholders who don't have insurance through their job have one choice for an insurance carrier to choose a policy from.
Now, we know that several high-profile elected officials have put together potential replacement plans.
Yes.
One of them is our own Senator Richard Burr put mm-hmm. together a plan, mm-hmm. I believe, a couple of years ago.
Yes.
As we wind down here, Catherine, is there any thread that you're seeing throughout all of these proposals mm-hmm. that you think will probably survive?
Yes, a lot of these proposals do sort of keep intact kind of what Donald Trump is saying that he would like to keep intact is the pre-existing insurance clause, having insurance companies. I mean, these are Republicans who are in favor of replacing Obamacare, repealing it, but still keeping intact some of those popular provisions. I may disagree with how that would be implemented, but that is a common thread. And also tax credits.
Catherine Restrepo is the Director of Healthcare Policy for the John Locke Foundation. Catherine, thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Criminology professor Mike Adams of UNC Wilmington has been one of the most vocal proponents in recent years of free speech on college campuses. During a recent speech in Raleigh, Adams unveiled his latest idea.
I believe there still is a cancer going within the system, and we need a more aggressive treatment. We need to go in this next legislative session, and we need to have comprehensive legislation. And that comprehensive legislation really needs to go and try and wipe out speech codes altogether. But there's something else that needs to be addressed. If you take a look at the history, I've been a college professor now for 23 years, and I know that for the first 20 years, the problem was that the campuses were dumping all of these policies on the heads of the students, and the students didn't know what was going on or didn't care. But something has changed over the course of the last few years. What I've noticed is that increasingly the students are demanding that their First Amendment rights be taken away. They are actually beginning to demand safe spaces. This is what happens when bad ideas float around for a generation. They become normalized. And the university is there and always willing to accommodate them. A dangerous thing that has started to occur over the course of the last few years has actually been microaggression training. The very first day on our college campuses, a freshman at the age of 18 goes and learns how to imagine being offended by new things that they never thought were offensive before and were uttered by people who had no intention whatsoever of offending them. What I think we need to do in new comprehensive legislation is I think we need to put an end to microaggression training. I think we need to be demanding of our public university system that they no longer teach 18-year-old college students things that aren't true about the First Amendment. And I think that the microaggression training needs to be replaced with First Amendment sensitivity training during orientation, teaching students what is true about the First Amendment. And what is true about the First Amendment is that we don't have a constitutional right to be unoffended. We have a constitutional right to be offended and to be offended with regularity, because that is the price of living in a free society.
UNC Wilmington Professor Mike Adams assessed the potential impact of Donald Trump's election as United States president.
I think he won quite a few votes on the backlash against political correctness. Without trying to break all of that down, there is one thing I think that can happen as a result of a Trump presidency that's really going to help us out a lot. Change in personnel at the Department of Education. That's extremely important. Now, if it were up to me, for example, I would actually repeal Title IX. I realize that that's not something that's going to happen. But this expansive interpretation of Title IX, it has everything to do with the bureaucrats who are currently in charge of the Department of Education and their worldview. And we've just had a worldview change. And I do predict that things will be better under the Trump presidency. I absolutely do predict that, just as things were better when Bush was president before. That's one thing that was better about the Bush. I have complaints certainly with the Bush administration, but their handling of matters with the Department of Education was certainly better than what happened during the Obama administration. So I do see an improvement there without question.
Adams says there already has been some good news when it comes to speech codes on college campuses.
If you go back 10 or 15 years and you ask people, well, what do you think about free speech on college campuses? What do you think about political correctness? What do you think about censorship? I think that there would be some people who had heard of the problem, and those people would assume that it was a problem with Northeastern liberal Ivy League schools. The fact of the matter is that if you go back about 15 years, there clearly was a point where the vast majority, I would say even before the fire came up with their green light, red light system, it was clear that there was a point where the vast majority of the college campus would have been red lights. We're certainly moving in the right direction. I think the last numbers that I've seen from the fire website is that the percentage of red light schools in the United States of America is down to about 45%. But the answer is that it is very widespread. It's not just private schools versus public schools. It's not just by region. It's the state schools and even the community colleges that have suffered from the systematic political correctness. And that's the bad news, is that it is very deeply entrenched in our educational system. The good news is that the numbers show that at least it's moving in the right direction.
That's UNC Wilmington criminology professor Mike Adams speaking recently in Raleigh. Adams explains why university leaders are likely to support restrictions on speech.
The fact of the matter is that these folks, after they've been professors for a number of years, after they get tenure, after they get promoted to full professor, hopefully without a 7.5-year lawsuit, they eventually become college administrators. They're codifying their worldview. I mean, if you really believe there's no such thing as objective truth, and you think that what we define as truth with scare quotes around it is simply an outgrowth of a power struggle, essentially, where the powerful people in our society get to define what is true and that things really don't have essences and there really is an objective truth, then why wouldn't you come along and create a policy that would empower people who don't have an equal share in the marketplace of ideas? I mean, that's where identity politics and political correctness comes from, this idea that rights don't belong to individuals, they belong to groups.
Adams returned to his theme of tackling First Amendment training for incoming college students.
The thing that I think that's most important is that we need to not just put out fires that are in front of us, but I think we need to take the long view, and I think we need to have a longer vision. And I think that involves being very proactive and actually going in and teaching students about the First Amendment on the first day that they arrive on the campus. And for me, the most important issue right now is replacing microaggression training with actual First Amendment training. And I also think, and this is something we need to be very careful about, I am concerned about the mob mentality that exists on our college campuses. You look at the incident that occurred at Mizzou. And it was disturbing that it was actually a professor of journalism and mass communications who said basically, you know, this public campus, this is our safe space. And if you've got a camera and you're a reporter, well, you can't come here and exercise your free. This is a journalism professor who's saying this and not only has this crazy idea, but thinks the way to enforce the idea is through violence. And she says, we need to strong arm these people. We need some muscle over here. Well, I'll tell you something. That really tells you that we have a very deep cultural problem on the campus. And it shows just how proactive that we've got to be. And it involves not just training, but I actually think there's got to be a consequence for that kind of behavior. Because that kind of thing, I actually see students doing this all the time. They do it in relation to their professors. They do it in relation to other students. They encounter an idea on campus they don't like. It might be a comment that's made during a lecture. It might be a flyer on a bulletin board. But students will often, I think, quite knowingly, file false harassment and hostile environment charges against other members of the university community with the express intention of shutting down their ideas. And you know something? I think we got to be very careful with this, but we need something like a little anti-Klan statute that says basically if you're going to come along and intentionally go and there's going to be, you know, attempted mob rule on campus where you're intentionally trying to suppress the civil rights of others, there has to be a consequence to that.
You've been listening to Mike Adams, professor of criminology at UNC Wilmington, one of North Carolina's most outspoken defenders of free speech on college campuses. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
At the John Locke Foundation, we're leading the effort to clean up the mess left behind by big government liberals. For decades, the powerful left in our state had piled on rule after rule, regulation after regulation, never really caring about the people whose lives are caught in the nightmare of complying. In other words, you. Their handiwork had made it tougher to get a job, even increased the legal risk of operating a business. We say enough is enough, that it's just not fair to you. That's why reform-minded lawmakers have turned to the Locke Foundation for answers, and they've acted to lighten your burden. We're proud that our intellectual firepower has improved lives. You can count on the John Locke Foundation to watch out for your interests, not the special interests. We would be honored to have your help in this fight. Go to johnlocke.org and make a tax-deductible donation right now. The John Locke Foundation. We're fighting for you. We're fighting for freedom.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at carolinajournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at carolinajournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at carolinajournal.com.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today, buy something nice, and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. A week before voters decided the outcome of North Carolina's gubernatorial race, Republican incumbent Pat McCrory announced plans for dealing with the aftermath of Hurricane Matthew, regardless of the election. The work starts with a special appointed committee.
The week of December 5th, the committee will develop recommendations to address remaining unmet needs with state and private funds. And by early December, we do expect Congress to appropriate supplement disaster assistance for North Carolina. Following that appropriation, I will submit a supplemental state disaster assistance package recommendations to our General Assembly and call for a special session. We're asking for a special session most likely in early December, although if there is activity earlier by the federal government, I will move forward earlier, late November, with the state legislature. But most likely, I do anticipate a special session, a date for early December, based upon some of the federal information we'll have weeks before. I expect to sign legislation from that special session that will fund recovery efforts, modify the school calendar laws, and make other changes to law as necessary to implement recovery as recommended by our committee. Throughout this process, the Hurricane Matthew Recovery Committee will be instrumental in engaging the private sector, fundraising for housing and small business recovery needs, and more important, developing long-term plans for sustainable recovery and resilient recovery.
McCrory says hurricane recovery is going to involve some tough decisions.
I am confident that we'll be able to recover and rebuild even stronger than what we had before in many of these areas impacted. But we do have some very difficult choices to make, when and how to rebuild, and the type of rebuilding that will occur. I am confident that we'll continue to see the best of North Carolina, and we're going to ask for all of North Carolina to assist those areas impacted.
North Carolina has a rainy day fund with more than $1.5 billion. Why call the General Assembly back to Raleigh for a special session?
The reason I want to go ahead and do a special session is so we can go and implement the plans to spend additional money. And we know we're going to need additional money, and just because you can't wait until the money's in hand to begin the process of those expenditures, based upon my experience as a mayor and a governor. You need leeway time, and you need guarantees that that money will be available. I don't want to wait until the end of January to get confirmation of those individuals that what our plans are.
That's North Carolina Governor Pat McCrory discussing work that will take place before the end of the year to address recovery from Hurricane Matthew. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups all across the state, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com, one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, plus opinion pieces and reports on higher education, all of that from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all of that, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina, spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Log on today.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina lawmakers continue to look for ways to eliminate, or at least consolidate, boards that issue work-related licenses. It's an idea the state's Program Evaluation Division has endorsed. Evaluator Chuck Heffron recently reminded lawmakers about some of the problems linked to licensing.
First, there are the increased costs associated with mandatory entry requirements. Studies have shown that occupational licensing increases the cost for the associated goods and services. For example, a study conducted by the National Bureau of Economic Research concluded that establishment of a licensing requirement results in an increase of approximately 15% in hourly earnings. Secondly, occupational licensing restricts the ability of individuals to obtain gainful employment in the occupation. Third, occupational licensing can restrict public access to services. The tasks that a licensee can perform are statutorily defined. If these task descriptions are not regularly updated to reflect advances in technology and practitioner competencies, public access to services will be restricted. Finally, occupational licensing limits the mobility of licensed professionals because licensing requirements often vary among states.
Heffern and his colleagues have identified a number of state licensing boards that ought to be consolidated or at least reviewed. They've also recommended creation of a new Occupational Licensing Commission to oversee that process.
To help ensure the Occupational Licensing Commission has the necessary expertise to perform these functions while representing the public interest, the commission should consist of both licensed individuals and members from the general public. The General Assembly may also wish to consider eliminating the commission upon completion of its assigned duties.
Lawmakers still have questions. Republican Representative Jeff Collins of Nash County wants to know how this process would affect the separate licenses he has now to sell insurance.
Under either one of those scenarios, does that mean we're doing away with licensing in either one of these, or just doing away with a licensing? In other words, if we do away with these two entities in 11 and 12, do I still have to have a license for health and life insurance, or can I just set up shop and sell it with no credentials? And I guess I would have the same question about the last one we looked at. Can I just call myself a recreational therapist and set up shop if we don't have that board, or are there still some requirements to call yourself whatever any of these things are, whether we have a licensing board or not?
Beyond specific questions, lawmakers wonder whether they really need a special Occupational Licensing Commission. Republican Sarah Stevens.
The question is, do we establish a commission and get somebody to pay for it, or is it something that we can do by breaking down these recommendations so far and saying we think these can be consolidated? I mean, and Representative Jordan keeps saying, what's the criteria we want to look at? Is there a hard and fast, and I don't think a hard and fast 1,500 members is a good rule. I don't know about the money. I think that's something we have to ask each of these individual boards. Are you able to effectively run? Can you get your online complaint process? Can you know what can be done to help? And the more people who have that technology already up and running, I think the more cost effective and easier it'll be for people to get. So I agree, we probably want to talk about what we hope to accomplish. And I think we all want to eliminate or consolidate the boards that we can.
Republican Representative Jonathan Jordan also questions the need to set up a new state commission.
I'm the one that's been saying we need more information before we can decide on these things. But I'm also, you know, averse to setting up a whole new bureaucracy, a whole new commission that when we haven't ourselves taken a shot at it. I think that we could take a shot at it and come up with some good things. If we find out that we can't, we get bogged down or whatever, we can always consider that as a possibility. But I would like to suggest we, you know, go with these objectives, pick what we all think would be the appropriate objectives of occupational regulation, and then let's start looking at the specific commissions and boards that PED has started with, and we could always add to that or subtract from that based on the other two methodologies that we've been given. But at least that will be a start, and we can start asking our questions about federal regulations and can you prove this board needs to make a presentation that they're protecting the public from harm, that the regulated individual is competent, that it considers the impact on state economic competitiveness, so they could help us respond with the details of their situations as to whether they should or should not be consolidated, eliminated, certified, whatever the recommendation may be.
Senator Andy Wells hopes North Carolina could do for occupational licensing what it already has done for tax policy.
In this General Assembly over the last 4 years, we've seen a considerable move in tax policy. And whether you like their philosophy and their methodology is one thing, but the Tax Foundation in 4 years has moved North Carolina from, as memory serves, 44th in the country to 11th. That is, we've gone from being non-competitive to competitive. I think we might find ourselves in a similar situation on licensing. We've got more licensees, more licensing boards than the states we're competing with. So we're adding a financial burden to our citizens with all of that. So I think one of the criteria I would like to look at, just as we did in tax reform, is how do we get competitive with the southeastern states, with the country as a whole? How do we limit our licensing boards in such a way by consolidation, by moving towards certification, where some of these boards have robust national certifications, And in fact, virtually every licensee, in some cases every licensee, also has a certification. So we've got a double layer there that could be unnecessary. So that's what I'd like to move toward. And in the case of the alarms that keeps coming up, those can be licensed without a licensing board. That is, effectively turning it into what would be considered a registration in a competitive sense. So there are a number, like the Tax Foundation, there are a number of national groups that are looking at us and evaluating this state on a regular basis, and we're not looking very good.
Wells even offered some specifics.
I would suggest that North Carolina does not extend licensure into areas where at least 50% of the states aren't licensing, and at least two of the surrounding or touching four states are. That is, without us, there'd only be two states. That would be a cap, my suggestion.
Other lawmakers didn't address that suggestion, but they were ready to adopt some general objectives to guide future debate about licensing. Representative Jonathan Jordan outlined those objectives.
Why do we even get into this issue? Well, to ensure that the public is protected from harm, so it's health and welfare and safety of the citizens. Provide assurances that the regulated individual is competent, actually know what they're doing. They have some kind of credentials of some sort, education or something. Provide a means to enforce the standards. So there's got to be, you know, complaints and then a way to deal with that. And having a license is a very good way to deal with potential bad actors. And then the Senator Wells made a very good point that at that high level, we're also looking at the impact of all of this on our state economic competitiveness.
You've been listening to highlights from a recent debate about the future of occupational licensing in North Carolina. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
At the John Locke Foundation, we're leading the effort to clean up the mess left behind by big government liberals. For decades, the powerful left in our state had piled on rule after rule, regulation after regulation, never really caring about the people whose lives are caught in the nightmare of complying. In other words, you. Their handiwork had made it tougher to get a job, even increased the legal risk of operating a business. We say enough is enough, that it's just not fair to you. That's why reform-minded lawmakers have turned to the Locke Foundation for answers, and they've acted to lighten your burden. We're proud that our intellectual firepower has improved lives. You can count on the John Locke Foundation to watch out for your interests, not the special interests. We would be honored to have your help in this fight. Go to johnlocke.org and make a tax-deductible donation right now. The John Locke Foundation. We're fighting for you. We're fighting for freedom. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Come January, the state agency charged with running K-12 education in North Carolina will have a new leader. Mark Johnson, a Republican, defeated multi-term incumbent June Atkinson to be state superintendent of public instruction. Now, Johnson inherits a massive responsibility and a system that increasingly faces competition from a surging school choice movement. Joining me to talk about the new leadership is Dr. Terry Stoops. He is Director of Research and Education Studies here at the John Locke Foundation. Terry, welcome back.
Thank you.
Tell us about Mark Johnson.
Well, he's an attorney, at least he will be until he starts the superintendent of public instruction. But he is an attorney for a software company, and he's a sitting member of the Forsyth County Board of Education. And he's a former teacher in West Charlotte, a very difficult place to teach, admittedly. But he taught for Teach for America for 2 years before he went to law school. So we have classroom experience on the district level, and I think he's going to bring a very good skill set to the position.
He might need all of that experience for all the things that he is going to be taking on. What do you think is his biggest challenge when he takes the oath?
Well, I think one of his challenges is the Department of Public Instruction itself. How is he going to manage it? Is he going to give school districts more flexibility and less oversight? How exactly is he going to run the department? Because that's one of his big responsibilities. It has several hundred people. They do lots of different things, everything from IT to testing. So that will be one of his biggest challenges is reshaping the Department of Public Instruction. He also has to think about how to use the soapbox. The superintendent of public instruction has a soapbox, and he's got a forum by which he can advance certain views, policy recommendations, etc. He has to figure out, am I going to use the soapbox to advance things that the State Board of Education supports, or is it going to be more trying to make sure that the General Assembly and the State Board of Education get along?
Is there anything that really stands out to you about his philosophy or his views based on what you have maybe read about him or heard him say during his time of service, particularly on the school board?
Well, he's an advocate for school choice. And one thing to note about Mark is he's young. He's a millennial. And you find that a lot of millennials really like the idea of school choice. They like choice in everything. So this is going to bring an interesting dynamic to the state education system. We have someone that's very young with a very different philosophy and outlook on life, is going to be looking at ways to make our school systems less 19th century and more 21st century.
That is so interesting that you would say that, because his job is with the traditional public school system, and yet he is an advocate of choice, and choice is really competition for the traditional classroom. So how does he balance all that?
Well, I think he sees those two different sectors as potentially working together. I mean, the idea of charter schools, for example, was that they would be laboratories to experiment with different ways of doing things, and that that would in turn translate into changes in the traditional system. So I think he sees that there can be a harmony between those two systems in particular. He was with Teach for America. I think he sees that alternative certification for teachers is also something that charter schools have, fewer requirements for teachers. I think he would like to see that sort of thing in the district. So there are things that I think, especially when you look at the charter sector, that he's going to look at taking some of those reforms and incorporating them into his work with the traditional public schools.
And some folks have really criticized charter schools, which, by the way, are public schools, but they've criticized the charter model because they say they were supposed to be innovative, but that there really haven't been those innovations really taken into the traditional classroom.
Yeah, that's an important point, because there are plenty of innovations out there, and there are plenty of charter schools just doing outstanding work, especially with low-income students. None of those reforms are making their way into the traditional system. Now, there are some regulatory barriers to some of the reforms that charter schools have to offer, but for the most part, there's very little acceptance of charter school reforms among the traditional public school population.
Fair to say that he would also be an advocate for kind of unleashing some of the regulatory reins that are on some of those innovative models?
Absolutely. That's going to require the General Assembly to pass laws that allow some of that flexibility. The other aspect of this is a Donald Trump presidency.
Ah.
Right before Trump was elected, the Department of Education was finalizing regulations for the Every Student Succeeds Act, ESSA, which is the new federal education plan. With Donald Trump in the White House, it's possible that that gets scrapped, or that the Republicans decide to revise it significantly to decrease the number of regulations that ESSA is providing for states. And it's substantial, especially when it comes to testing and reporting. I would love to see Donald Trump take on ESSA and find a way to make it less onerous on states. I don't know if that's going to happen. It's probably not going to be one of his major priorities, but this is going to influence what we can do as a state once we figure out what kind of flexibility can be had using our own general statutes.
You're describing a completely new dynamic, and you're smiling. I should tell our listeners that as we're talking, you're smiling here. You think that there's some good things that could be happening here.
Yes, I actually really do. We have looked at No Child Left Behind and several other different types of programs that the federal government has tried to force upon states, and they haven't been all that successful. They've done some good things. No Child Left Behind got every state to look at ways of reporting required states to report for students based on their socioeconomic status, based on race, and I think that was very good. But for the most part, states are laboratories of innovation and should be allowed to be that. The federal government should have less of a role in what we do in education in North Carolina, and I think the election of Donald Trump will head in that direction.
Now, when Mark Johnson does become the superintendent of public instruction in January, he also will face competition from people who are not enrolling their kids in the traditional public system that he will be overseeing. You've got growth in homeschools, growth in private schools. How do you think he will respond to that? Will he encourage people to come back to a traditional system or just choose what they want?
They have to have a system to come back to that is comparable in quality and provides the types of things that the private or homeschool provides, whether it be individualized instruction, et cetera, et cetera. So I think he's going to see his challenge as making the traditional system so good that parents are going to want to choose it over homeschools or private schools. We're far from there, but I think that if he's going to approach that, that's the correct way to approach it. You want to improve the quality of the product, not just expect that parents are going to take up that product because it's the biggest one or it's the one that they're expected to go to. I think that will probably be one of his biggest challenges.
Well, his name is Mark Johnson, and he will be the new head of the State Department of Education. What's the official state agency name?
Department of Public Instruction.
There you go. Yeah. And he will be the superintendent of that state agency come January. A big change in leadership. We've been talking with Dr. Terry Stoops. He is the Director of Research and Education Studies at the John Locke Foundation. You can read all of his work at johnlocke.org and carolinajournal.com. Terry, thank you.
Thank you.
And that's all the time we have for the show this week. On behalf of Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.